Okay, we're bringing the public safety policy and finance committee to order, and we'll start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gauthier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis.
Here.
Slocum. Smith.
Here.
Representative Smith, you want to move the minutes from the previous meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I've read them, so moved.
You hear no objections? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Here, minutes read. Good morning. We looking forward to your appearance here today, and I don't know how you folks want to handle this, but whoever wants to go first, as many times before this committee, say your name loudly and clearly and who you represent and start out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start out this morning. My name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and I'm glad to be here this morning and to see some very familiar faces and also see some new faces. And we look forward to coming back in front of this committee to talk about other divisions within this committee's jurisdiction and within the Department of Public Safety. I bring greetings from the Commissioner's office, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Superintendent Virga, who will walk you through the services of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
And committee members. My name is Dave Virga, and I'm the Acting Superintendent at the Minnesota BCA, and I want to thank you for allowing us to come here today and present our operation to you. We didn't know how deeply you wanted to drill into BCA operations this morning, and we have quite a bit of content here, so we're going to get through it as expeditiously as we can so that we can leave plenty of time for questions at the end and you can get to the things that you really want to know about. You've been given a BCA fact sheet, and that's the one with the map on it. There's a lot of information in that document, and probably more than we'll be giving today. If you want to follow along with that or you want to use that as a reference, that's great. We'll take any questions in regards to those. In order to move this along, the mission statement is on the fact sheet and along with the BCA values. So I'm going to skip ahead because I really want to, we're very proud of our organization. We do a lot. We bring a lot to public safety. I want to make sure we get on to that today. This is just a quick look at the BCA budget. It's about $42.5 million total, all of which, except for approximately $1.9 million, comes from the general fund. The $1.9 comes from the trunk highway fund, which is used in the BCA laboratory. The bureau hierarchy is set up with the superintendent on the top. The forensic science laboratory as being one division, investigations being a second, administrative services being the third, and the Minnesota Justice Information Services division being the fourth block of the BCA structure. And what I've done today is, I'm the acting superintendent. I am also the assistant superintendent. The assistant superintendent runs the investigations for the state of Minnesota for the BCA. I will be talking about investigations, and then I have the other division directors here to explain what's going on in their sections also. In the BCA investigative section, we have the Crimes Against Persons, or CAP unit, Special Investigations, which is our narcotics unit, St. Paul and Bemidji regional offices. Those folks are general investigators, and I'll get into all these functions a little bit individually down the road here. The Financial Crimes Task Force is not a real division of the BCA. However, we're deeply invested into that particular group, and we think that is the future of investigations in the state. And I'll talk a little bit about the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, of which we have a House member and a senator on the Task Force Advisory Board. And then the MNJAC, the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, which is the State Information Gathering Fusion Center. In the Crimes Against Persons Unit, or CAP unit, we have the Internet Crimes Against Children, ICAC, the Predatory Offender Investigations Unit, and the Predatory Offender Registration. The ICAC unit has been a part of the BCA. The BCA has had its own ICAC unit for approximately 5 years now. And these are the agents and the analysts and the forensic computer examiners that look into the Internet crimes against children, the child pornography, the solicitation of children for pornographic works, that sort of thing. In June of 2010, the BCA received a grant which had previously been held by the St. Paul Police Department, and it was an agreement between St. Paul and the BCA that eventually we would assume this grant. Chief Harrington at the time orchestrated this for the grant to come to the BCA, and now we administer the statewide ICAC grant, of which there are 80 local affiliates. And a local affiliate means that there's a local officer that's been trained and has received equipment and software for the investigation of Internet crimes against children. And we have these 80 affiliates around the state. They're managed by a senior special agent from the BCA. And then we also still have the St. Paul ICAC group in our building also working hand-in-hand with our folks. So that is something that affects us statewide. The DOJ grant allows us to pay for the affiliates' training, the equipment, and then the software, like I said. The predatory offender investigations, we've had predatory offender investigation agents. This is a sworn unit at the BCA. And let me go back a little bit. We have 54 agents and special agents in charge. 58 sworn, basically. That's our complement of investigators around the state. And sort of keep that in mind as we're going through this. We really try and stretch our manpower around the state. We partner with locals and federal people as much as possible to benefit us in a lot of ways and get further reach throughout Minnesota. But the Predatory Offender Investigation Group are sworn agents whose purpose is to locate, apprehend, and bring into compliant, non-compliant predatory offenders. They do this by working with the locals. They work with the U.S. Marshals Task Force, who also has a duty to find these folks. And then also our agents provide training to the local officers in regards to changes in the law on predatory offenders, how to locate predatory offenders. We have a lot of means to do that. This group is dedicated to find those folks. The Predatory Offender Registration section is a civilian section. That's the group that actually registers the predatory offenders. They work with the county attorney's office. They provide the packets. If a offender is found to be non-compliant, these are the folks that put together those prosecution packets to charge, maybe prosecute, but at the very least bring these folks into compliance. We've been registering predatory offenders since 1991. Currently, there is over 16,000 registered offenders in Minnesota. Minnesota has a 93% compliance rate. And of the remaining 7%, half of those offenders are outside of the state of Minnesota and are no longer under our jurisdiction, so they fall under the jurisdiction of whatever state they're currently residing in. So we have a pretty high compliance rate in the state. And we get approximately 120 to 140 new registered offenders every month in Minnesota. The Special Investigations Unit, two primary functions. One is to investigate high-level narcotics traffickers, and then we do that through performing undercover operations. The main focus today is working conspiracy cases. These are long-term, very involved, but we're shooting for the upper echelon of the drug offenders. Other groups around the state work on the mid and lower level street offenders. The Technical Operations Group, they're the folks that conduct the wiretap investigations. They do covert surveillance and they electronic surveillance. These are our WISMO guys with all the computers and the cameras and the listening devices and those sorts of things. That's the Special Investigations Unit. As a force multiplier, we have agents from the Special Investigations Unit assigned to the Minneapolis DEA office, to the Fargo DEA office. We have an agent assigned to ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The purpose of that agent assigned to ICE is to deal with juvenile trafficking and in prostitution and involuntary servitude. And then something else that's fairly unique is we have an agent assigned and also a technical person assigned to the Safe Trails Task Force, which is in northern Minnesota. It's an FBI-run task force, multi-jurisdictional, state, local, and federal. And the primary jurisdiction for the Safe Trails Task Force are the three reservations of Leech Lake, Red Lake, and White Earth. And they're concentrating their efforts on those areas. And folks from those police departments from those three geographical locations are part of the Safe Trails Task Force. The St. Paul and Bemidji Regional Office, these are the folks, our general investigators. We call them our dead body guys because mostly they do death investigations and conflict cases. They assist with the cold case investigations. We do the majority of officer-involved shootings and conflict cases that involve force for greater Minnesota. And so we have quite a presence in greater Minnesota. This is also the group that is involved in crime scene and crime scene processing. And then this group also has two agents assigned to the FBI Safe Streets Task Forces, one in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul, to combat mostly gang, drug, and homicidal violence within Ramsey and Hennepin County within the metro area. A good example of what this group does is currently, and we have a case going on up in Carlton County that came in on Sunday. It's a double homicide. And Carlton County does not have the resources or the manpower to pursue a case like this. It's a whodunit, and they're deeply involved in it. They called our agent. He went down, took a look at the scene, called our crime scene team. So our crime scene folks spent a day and a half in this crime scene. We've now set up a command post, and it's a full-blown multi-jurisdictional operation, which was fully functional by about Tuesday afternoon. So that's kind of illustrates what we do out state with these investigations. I just want to go back also, we don't have a high number of agents, so we try to position them in areas around the state fairly strategically. We have our headquarters in St. Paul, and we have a regional office in Bemidji. The regional office in Bemidji also has a lab attached to it, which Mr. Dolish will address in a little bit here. But we have 10 field offices around the state also, and that's on your fact sheet. It's on the front cover there. That's where we're located out state. I spoke earlier just a little bit about the Financial Crimes Task Force, and I'm personally convinced that this is an entity that needs some attention, and it also needs some backing. In many of the crimes, what's going on is you can follow the money in gangs, drugs, prostitution, those sorts of things. You can follow the money. The Financial Crimes Task Force has evolved into a real player in the state of Minnesota. The BCA, this is not a part of us. However, the commander of the task force is a BCA employee, and I have three agents assigned to the Financial Crimes Task Force. And the kinds of cases that they're doing now are very high level and are being overseen by the U.S. Attorney's Office and a couple of the Metro County Attorney's Offices. This thing has evolved, this Financial Crimes Task Force, to a place now where I think that it is the future. They're doing these large multinational cases, and we're going to continue to assist this unit as much as we can. It's made up of six local agencies, along with federal partners, including the IRS, the Secret Service, and Postal. The Minnesota Joint Analysis Center is the fusion center. It's been at the BCA for about going on 4 years now. And the fusion center collects, analyzes, and disseminates information on organized criminal activities, terrorist information, and even more important, the all hazards activities around the state. It doesn't necessarily have to be law enforcement, but quality of life sorts of things. And it's a state-based point of contact that coordinates information between federal, state, and local agencies. In the interest of time, I'm going to end that piece on the investigative section. Before I forget, I know that there's new members here on this committee, and if you want to come over as a committee or you want to arrange it individually, we'd love to have you come over to the BCA, take you around to the different divisions, and really drill down and show you our operations. So I throw that out to everyone on the committee here. And now I'd like to present Janelle Rasmussen from Administrative Services.
Good morning. Go ahead and give your name and title. And
good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janelle Rasmussen, and I work in our Administrative Services section at the BCA. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to share some of the work that we do. I wanted to highlight a few of our services and programs that you see listed here on the screen. The Administrative Services section was organized after a strategic plan and analysis of bureau-wide operations in order to streamline our services, be more cost-effective, and provide better services to our customers throughout the state of Minnesota. We've made a number of changes that have had successful results. The Criminal Justice Training and Education Unit is an area where business processes were changed. Last year, we held almost 200 training events and trained over 5,900 officers, investigators, chief sheriffs, and other criminal justice partners in the state. Training has been provided in the areas of investigations, police management and leadership, forensic science, criminal justice information, and a number of other areas. We are also bringing training out state, and in doing so in the most cost-effective ways possible in order to provide that training to the local agencies at a cost that they can afford to get their staff and officers the training that they need. The Minnesota Amber Alert Plan was implemented in Minnesota in 2002, and since that time we have issued 23 alerts. In each case, the child has been successfully recovered alive and the suspect has been apprehended. And it wouldn't be right to talk about Amber Alert today without mentioning that it's National Amber Alert Awareness Day today, which is the anniversary of Amber Hagerman, who was abducted and murdered in Arlington, Texas. Her killer has never been found. Since we began in Minnesota, we have helped to develop other plans in other states and countries as well, and have presented best practices each year at the national conference. We are used as a model throughout the nation, and that is a direct result of the partnerships from Minnesota businesses, broadcasters, and the communities throughout the state. Our work helping other states has benefited us in Minnesota as well. When Cindy Bruno was abducted from St. Cloud, Minnesota, investigators had reason to believe she was going to Utah. We requested Utah activate their statewide Amber Alert plan, and a state trooper sitting on the highway in Utah was calculating the amount of time it would take to get from St. Cloud, Minnesota to his location when he looked up, the van drove right by him. He was able to locate Cindy, apprehend the suspect, and then, of course, was later recognized for his work in that case. We continue every day to look for new opportunities and new ways to get the word out on abducted children. We're using Facebook and other social media tools and continue to welcome any new ideas that anyone may have. We also have the statewide Missing and Unidentified Persons Clearinghouse, which serves as a resource to both law enforcement and the families of those that are missing. With the change to the Missing Children's Act to Brandon's Law, we have went providing services on missing children's cases to missing persons cases in the state of Minnesota. The clearinghouse works with law enforcement to offer resources on these cases, and in 2010, we had 10,709 missing person reports in our state. In addition to that, we also track every single missing person report that is made into the National Crime Information Center to ensure that every step is being taken to track those cases, including collecting DNA, getting fingerprints, dental records, and making sure that all the information that is entered is correct and accurate so that if there is a possibility to make a match, we can do so. We do this on all of our cases that are considered to be long-term, which is over 30 days, because in most cases when someone is missing for over 30 days, it's unlikely that they'll return home. We currently have 393 of these cases. And today in Minnesota, 555 individuals are entered as missing, including juveniles and children. We also work directly with the families of missing children or missing people, missing adults, and we coordinate with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children on things like age progression and returning kids home who have been found in other states or other countries. We also provide resources to the families that they might not have through the National Center and their funding. The Minnesota Crime Alert Network was created after the abduction and murder of Grant Hussey from Eden Prairie. The network was created to provide a tool for law enforcement agencies to quickly alert the public about a crime or a criminal and to ask for their help in solving the crime. Today, the network has over 15,000 members, consisting of businesses, media, law enforcement, and other members in 52 different categories. Alerts are sent statewide in major cases, like the case Superintendent mentioned, and also by region, county, city, whenever necessary. Law enforcement has the ability to select where in the state they'll send the alert and also to who will receive the alert. Hundreds of alerts go out each week, resulting from burglaries, stolen items, scrap metals, homicides, missing vulnerable adults. State law also requires that every scrap metal dealer register for the Crime Alert Network and look at every alert they receive regarding stolen scrap to prevent thieves from coming into their location and selling it at their business. Successes occur every day as a direct result of law enforcement sending out this information and the public reporting information back in. In 2007, the Crime Alert was used to alert the state of Minnesota about a Wisconsin man who had taken his four children and was believed to be heading to Canada, and the children were in danger. The Crime Alert went to a fax machine at a resort outside of Two Harbors, Minnesota. An employee saw the alert and recognized the man as just checking into the Two Harbors Resort. He contacted the Lake County Sheriff's Office, who responded immediately and was able to safely recover the four children before they were harmed. Wisconsin passed a law last session creating the Wisconsin Crime Alert modeled after the Minnesota plan. The BCA also has the statewide DARE and crime prevention programs where we assist local agencies with training and program assistance in these areas. Internet safety is another program. It has been compared to driver's education in that we would not let our children drive first without educating them. We have seen many children fall victim to horrific crimes on the internet due to lack of education. The statewide internet safety program works to provide training to law enforcement, parents, teachers, and students. We attempt to give parents and teachers the tools that they need to help educate their children. Last year, we sent to every school in the state of Minnesota a NetSmarts training program so that teachers could use that program to educate their children if they chose to do so. We're also in the process of doing train-the-trainer courses throughout the state and getting people that information, and to date have trained over 11,000 individuals in the state of Minnesota. The BCA Operations Center also houses the statewide duty officer program, which is the statewide link in any state emergency. During this last year, the duty officers processed over 9,000 calls and made 38,000 notifications to other state agencies. They are the point of contact for nuclear emergencies, natural disasters, chemical spills, and pretty much any other statewide disaster. In addition, they also do all of the call-outs for the BCA crime scene team, investigators, and act as their communications when the agents are out in the field. Those are some of the services that we provide in our section, and be happy to give you more details or share more information with you at a later time.
Thank you very much.
Frank Dulish from the lab will be coming up next to share some of the services.
Oh, got a question here if you want to hold up just a second in case it's for you. Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chairman, Janelle, just a question for you in regarding to the Two Harbors incident where the fax came into the resort. In lieu of fax machines becoming extinct, and people getting emails, what assurances do you have that people will be able to see those? We get so much emails and junk emails, not oftentimes we get to read those. In the case when a fax comes in, you read it, you hear it, and you see it. So just curious, what mechanisms are there in place to hopefully overcome that obstacle?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we have the capability of sending alerts by email, by fax, by cell phone, text message. We can get that information out. It's up to the individual business or school or law enforcement agency when they sign up to decide how they want to get that information. What we found in thinking that people were not going to use their fax machines anymore is that they actually are. The gas stations, grocery stores, those people aren't sitting on their computers reading their emails. They're actually working at the desk and like at the resort. So they want to get their alerts for immediate information right there on their fax machine in the front area. And that's how a lot of our businesses get their information, is by fax.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you. I just threw my fax machine away the other day, so I'll maybe have to get another one. So thank you, Janelle. Thank
you. Where'd you throw it?
I recycled it.
A Representative Mullery, and then Representative Grunagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That unit that Patty Wetterling's with for prevention of sexual abuse, have we ever funded it from the state, or is that all still federal, and is the federal going to continue, do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I'm not familiar with where their funding comes from.
Oh, okay. I know that at one time it was off federal, and I was worried if it was going to be continued somehow. Maybe you could check on that.
Absolutely, I'd be happy to check and get back to you.
Representative Grunagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rasmussen and Mr. How do you say that?
Bjerga.
Bjerga? Okay, it's almost as bad as Grunagan. No. Anyway, I certainly appreciate the work you do and respect it, and keeping the citizens of the state of Minnesota, especially the children, safe. And I want to do everything as a representative to encourage and be supportive of that area. But, you know, I've been on the school board for 16 years, and one of the things I find helpful in assessing some of these budgets and stuff, and maybe the data will come forth in the future, is comparative data. In other words, in the school board, our audit would show us a comparison not only of our school district in certain areas, but also compared to similar size school district and as a state as a whole. When I look at your budget, $42 million, first thing I think is, what are other states with similar populations spend in these particular areas, and to a certain degree a breakdown of how they spend their money? Should we be spending more in one area versus what we're doing? And I understand crime's different in different parts of the country, but two states in particular that come to mind that I think you could reference would be Colorado and Indiana. Both of them have a similar number of population in their state. How much are they spending in this, you know, total for their Bureau of Criminal Apprehension? And then a little bit of a breakdown as to the differences, or why we're spending more in one area versus another. And just as a new legislator, it helps me to be better able to look at these budgets and see what areas we maybe need support in, or there's maybe overspending on. And I'm not sure we're overspending on anything with the level of crime that we experience in our society today. Anyway, one last question. Having been on the school board, I was especially attuned to this internet problem with students trying to access or being solicited on the internet. Now, we put a block system in our school district, but is there any way to put a statewide block system in place that would block some of these sites from our young people, especially children, accessing sites which are extremely, number one, corrupting and even dangerous to them? I don't know if there's such technology exists, but I often thought, why not just block this, you know, put a block to keep these sites out of the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Rasmussen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not familiar with any statewide blocks. I know that a lot of the schools do have WebSense programs where they're blocking the students from getting to certain sites at their schools, but I would be happy to check and see if there's anything
available.
Yeah, like
if there's
any
state, Ms. Chairman, Mr. Rasmussen, if there's any state that does something like that, you know what I mean? And then just would I'd appreciate a response from Mr. Bjerga on the comparative data.
Yes, sir. Question. I have that down.
Mr. Berger.
We'll get back to you on that.
Do you think that's a good idea?
Mr. Grun.
Absolutely.
I come back and forth through the chair.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Grunhagen.
Yeah.
Yes, I will definitely check with those two states and get a breakdown of their budget.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Grunhagen. I'll try to work on my technique in my office with my L.A. so I do it more appropriately. Thank you.
No problem. All right, thank you. Anything else? Any other questions from the committee members? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This goes back to Superintendent Bjerka's presentation. Superintendent, on the question of predatory offender registration, do you know what the demographics of this are? I think I'm correct in saying that the only way that you get off of the predatory offender registration list is by death. And if we're increasing the number of registrations by 120 or 140 per month, can you predict what ultimately we're likely to experience in terms of the number of registrants in the state and what the implications are for keeping track of all of them?
Mr. Bjerger.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Hilty.
Representative Hilty, I'm sorry. I don't have my glasses on. That's difficult to predict. I do know that because of the number of offenses that persons are required to register for, that number has increased, and so therefore so has the folks required to register. I would have to get back to you with the specific demographics, and as far as that you need to die basically to get off of the predatory offender list, I don't even know if that works. So I would have to get back to you on that and give you better data. I don't have it in front of me, sir.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair and Superintendent Bjerga, I think that would be an important thing to look into, because it does, of course, you know, there's a cost associated with keeping track of all these people, and I think it would be very useful both to you and to this committee to know what we're looking at in the future, just in terms of the demographic implication.
Absolutely. Excuse me, sir. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Hilty, I will get back to you on that. I will talk to the agent in charge that runs that particular section, and we will find that information.
Thank you.
Representative Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sorry, I've always known you as Whitey. So everybody says we can't pronounce his name, so we call him Whitey. I think Representative Hilty brings up a good point. As we build these up, it makes it very difficult for the citizens and others to really make use of this data. I mean, if I look up in North Minneapolis and there's 100 I have to go through, okay, but the way this thing's going, you know, if in a few years I've got thousands to go through, doesn't the data become meaningless to the factor? Part of this was to let people, general public, be aware so that they can look into that. Now, some of them, and I don't know which ones are open, which ones aren't, but I can't remember that. Some are open to the public, some just to schools, some to law enforcement, whatever. As it builds up the number of people you have to look at, even for law enforcement, doesn't it make it, if there's no selectiveness to it and everybody just stays on for life, is there some point at which it becomes impossible for even schools or law enforcement, much less the general public, to really make use of it the way the intention was?
Mr. Berger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I don't disagree, but I think that there is some process in when these folks are put onto the web so that you can check and see who's in your neighborhood. You gave the example of going from 10 to 100. I think that there is, and I need to research this, but I believe that there is a way that you exclude the ones that really no longer apply. There is a way, and I don't know how else to say that, but there is a way to winnow that down and still make it meaningful. And what I need to do is talk to the person who's in charge of that unit and get the actual mechanics for doing that. There is a list, the 16,000 that I mentioned, does not include those that are deceased, and there's some caveats in here. So it still is pertinent, it still is worthwhile, it still is meaningful, But as I sit here today, I can't give you the specifics of it. And I can provide that to you in the future or bring in the person who actually runs that unit, and we can discuss that with you at that time.
It's my understanding there's a very low number of actual offenders that are on the public website compared to all of the sex offenders, like 660 or something out of 19,000. Personally, I know there's going to be a bill to load a lot more on, but with it, maybe we could get some high-tech software that can zero in, so when you have a map of Minnesota, you touch your city, and it'll show you all these people, and there's got to be a way we can figure it out where it's not so difficult to sort through these names, but I think there's going to be a bill coming through that puts at least level 2 and maybe level 3 on the public website instead of just, or level 1 and 2. Is it level 3s that are only ones on there now, or what is
how? On the public, I believe, is level 3, yes. Yes,
sir. Any other questions? All right, are you finished?
Yes, thank you.
All right, then the next person we have is?
Laboratory Director Frank Dolish.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Cornish and members, I'm Frank Dolish from the BCA. I'm the director of the Forensic Science Service. I'm going to be really quick because I know that we have time constraints. And again, would offer that if you want more information or want to be able to come and see us in person, sometimes that's the picture is worth 1,000 words and can give you a lot of information that way as too. The BCA has two laboratories in the state of Minnesota, one in St. Paul, which is our major facility, and then a regional or a limited service laboratory in Bemidji. We have a staff of about 104. About 84 of those are our forensic scientists that work in the various specialties, analyzing evidence that is submitted to the laboratory from all types of crimes. Overview you see on our on this organizational chart shows a breakdown of some of our various specialty areas in the laboratory. We have a mitochondrial DNA lab, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that particular lab is actually funded by the FBI, totally funded by the FBI. We have 9 scientists that are working on that. Those types of cases, they get cases from all over the country, and you might ask, well, what's in it for Minnesota to do this? About 25% of the cases that unit works can come from Minnesota. It would be an activity that we probably wouldn't have had had we not had this partnership with the FBI. About a year ago, we entered into a second partnership with the FBI, and under that same unit now we have what is called a missing persons DNA unit. Again, that has 4 scientists, again fully funded by the FBI, so we have some good partnerships going with our federal partners. Also related to DNA, you'll see on this chart a CODIS laboratory that stands for Combined DNA Analysis, and that's where we store all of the DNA samples from convicted felons in the state of Minnesota. I have some data that I'll share with you later on that unit. And then our nuclear DNA unit, and I'll share a little bit more about that. Our other sections, we have a chemistry lab where we have drug examinations. They identify things like street drugs. We have a trace evidence section that works with evidence like hairs and fibers and soil. And other things like shoe prints and tire tracks, anything that like that that might come from a crime scene. We have a toxicology laboratory that is involved with primary thing that we're involved with at that unit is DWI, alcohol and drugs, and I'll give you a little more information on that as I go along. We also run the statewide breath testing program, which are the currently the intoxilizers. I'll spend a little more time on that. And then we have our criminalistics laboratory sections. We have a unit that does firearms and tool marks, a two-person unit that does things related to documents, handwriting, handprinting, forgeries, anything that relates to what we call question documents, and then a latent fingerprint section. And some of those are mirrored in Bemidji, the drugs, latent prints, DNA, and firearms are all sections that we also have in the Bemidji lab. This chart just shows you a little bit of a split between the counties that are served by the lab in Bemidji and St. Paul. And since Bemidji doesn't have all the services, we do have to share cases. If there are things that they don't have services for, we ship those cases down to St. Paul. I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about nuclear DNA and trying to focus on some areas that I thought the committee might be interested in. First of all, what is it? It is not the entire genome. So when you hear that the BCA is doing DNA analysis on something, we're not doing a complete genome sequence of an individual. We're looking at those parts of the genome that help us to identify an individual. So there are just a limited number of variable sites that we're interested in that helps us to identify people. And so when we're talking about putting in DNA profiles into the CODIS or DNA database, we're not putting in the entire person's genome. We're only putting information on a select number of sites on the gene into that database.
Mr. Dolish?
Yes.
While we're on that subject, familial DNA has come up, and it was rather intriguing to me. And how much research have you done on that, and would you be able to accomplish the purpose that you've heard about in the news media, and how would that be funded?
Mr. Chairman, I am familiar with familiar DNA. It's essentially looking at, because you do share some common things with your brothers and sisters and relatives, there is a certain portion of what's in our database that could be searched, and we call it a limited search. They'd be just looking at, instead of looking at 15 places on the gene, you might be looking for 8. It is something that we've talked about a lot. We would love to talk to the committee about this issue, and are interested in guidance on whether we should get into this or not. Depending on how much you use it, it could be very expensive, and I know that might be a concern. I know that California, we've researched what California has done. They limit the use of this type of technology to very high-profile cases. They have a process that they have put in place to determine which types of cases they might be able to do those on. With those kinds of focuses, I think that we could probably do something like that without it being too terribly expensive. So it depends on how broad you want to paint this brush and how much you want to use that technology.
There's a good chance it'll come back, and I might be the author or co-author, and so we'll probably have you back then and talk more about it. And
yes.
Be thinking about it in the meantime, get your figures together.
Mr. Chairman, and just like our superintendent mentioned, at that time I'll bring along my DNA scientist that really can speak to this, Mr. Jim Iverson, who has researched this quite well.
Okay, sounds good. Go ahead now.
Yeah. in the DNA area, it's one of the areas where we've had a significant increase in cases over the years. We've had almost a over a 50% increase in cases, and part of that is due to the fact that we can get DNA off of smaller and smaller amounts of material. When we started out the DNA program in the early 90s, you would need a blood sample the size of a dime to get DNA off of. Today, if we have a hat or a piece of clothing that you've worn, or if you drank out of a glass or touched something, it's possible that we might be able to get the individual's DNA off of those items. So because we can get it off of more items, we have more interest from law enforcement, and we're looking at a lot more different types of cases and a lot more evidence. We have been able to do that without a large increase in staff by utilizing new technologies with robotics. We brought in outside consultants to do some process mapping to look at our efficiencies in the area. And even with this increase, we have decreased the turnaround time in that area. So a year ago, we were doing about 25% of our cases in the DNA area less than a month, and on this last year, we were doing at least 34%. We'd like that to be better, and we're still working on that. I mentioned the mitochondrial DNA unit. It's different. Mitochondrial DNA is different from nuclear DNA in that it comes from the mitochondrial and is inherited through the mother's part. So your mother and any siblings will all have the same mitochondrial DNA. It's not quite as effective in identifying somebody in terms of having large numbers, where you could say that the profile would only match one person in the population of the world. On the other hand, there are a lot more copies of it in your body, and it's not broken down when it's subjected to heat and other things like that. So it's a lot better for things like missing persons and when nuclear DNA can't be found. Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Dolish, in regards to that mitochondrial DNA, what did you mean when you said fully funded, or what does fully funded mean? And then do the feds pay the medical and pensions and so forth?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes. They pay the entire salary, fringe. They pay for all of the supplies and equipment that unit uses. If they have to go to court and travel and or any training they need, they pay for all of that. What Minnesota contributes is the space in the building and the administrative my time to administer that function.
Thank you.
I mentioned the DNA database. Question you might have is how many samples do we have in that now? We get samples from anybody that's convicted of a felony in the state of Minnesota, and we have over 100,000 samples in that database currently. That is also connected to the FBI, so we upload our profiles to the federal DNA database, so other states can search against that. If they have a hit against a sample in our database, it's a pointer system, and the FBI would tell them that they have to contact Minnesota so that we can make sure that if there are differences in laws and what can be available, that we can work that out. And that would be the same way that would happen if we had a hit against a sample that was from Wisconsin. We did have 335 hits in 2009 and up to 734. So we are linking a lot of cases using this database. Our DWI alcohol and drugs program is one that I wanted to mention a little bit. Some of you probably have heard that there's been a challenge to the intoxilizer and the source code has been requested, and we actually have very large consolidated case that has just been heard, and we're waiting for the attorneys to file briefs and submit them to the judge by the end of the month. And Judge Abrams is the judge that's hearing this case, consolidated case, is expecting to make a ruling sometime after that in the next few months. Now, that being said, at the same time, we've gotten some federal money through the Traffic Safety Administration and to replace the breath test instruments in the state of Minnesota. So we have already selected a new instrument to replace the intoxilizer. We didn't do that because of the lawsuit. We did that because these instruments were about 10 years old, and it was time to replace them. So in the next few months, we're going to start rolling out replacement instruments, and it will not be an intoxilizer anymore. It's called DataMaster. It's a completely different company. We've made sure in the procurement of it that if the issue of the source code comes up again, that they will be able to get it. So we, if it is raised with this instrument, we can resolve that issue quickly. We will be rolling them out starting in the southern part of the state, and then working our way up by State Patrol District, probably starting in the spring. Hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have replaced about 280 breath test instruments that are scattered around the state. I put this slide on here because the impact that this has had is that a lot of departments started using blood and urine alcohol. So in 2006, we had about 33,000, 34,000, or I take that back, fluid tests, 6,500 blood and urine tests, and this last year we've had more than double that many. So we've had over almost 15,000 blood and urine tests that we've had to run, and we've had to do that with current resources again, and we've done that by reassigning some staff and by doing whatever we can to make this as efficient as possible. It's a big increase for us in that area.
Mr. Dolish?
Yes.
Out of those two, and maybe it was on the graph, which one went up more, the blood or the urine, in proportion?
I will have to get back to you.
It's not a biggie, but when do you think we'll get to the point where the officer can just administer the test, the breath test there, and it'll be accepted and have to run them, instead of having to run them to clear in to use the big machine? Are we anywhere near that sophistication level? Or I know they got flashlights now that you can put inside the car that measure it, but they're not considered.
There is some even newer technology that I've been following that is very interesting to me, and the units that we're going to be buying can be portable. But they're not as portable as the PVTs that we have out there now, so I kind of hesitate to call them portable, but they could be put in a unit if they needed to be. I part of the problem is whether or not the courts and will accept that technology, and you know, we have a very active defense bar in the state, and so that has a lot to do with it.
Representative Mullery. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, what you did tipped me off. You mentioned how you could get DNA from so many things now, and the chair coughed, and I thought, wow, if I see you up looking at these things or your staff afterwards, can you get it off of that, or just people handling the chairs back there or things like that? Has it got that sophisticated? Or?
Yes. Mr. Chairman.
So don't cough in here.
Anybody else? Okay, Mr. Dolish, go ahead.
The last thing I just wanted to mention, that so that you know that you can have confidence in our laboratory. Our laboratory is, both laboratories are fully accredited by the American Society of Crime Lab Directors. It's an ISO 17025 base program. I can give you a lot more information on the lab, but I know we're probably over our time anyway, and others are going to be wanting to talk and maybe have questions, so I'll leave it at that.
Any more questions from the members? All right, who's next?
David Johnson from the Minges section.
David and I were cops together in a life previous to this. Mm-hmm. Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chair, you and I once were both young.
Yeah.
Times have changed, haven't they?
They sure have. Geography.
Well, I'm David Johnson, Executive Director of Minnesota Justice Information Services at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And we are the gateway to the state's criminal justice information. We are the focus for integration with our goal of delivering accurate and complete information with the general purpose of using that to make the citizens safer and making better public safety decisions. In 2008, we integrated the Criminal Justice Information Services section at the BCA with the CrimNet program office, put them under the executive director, and that has been moving forward since August of 2008 with the goal of having a more streamlined approach, a more broad-based approach, and making sure all aspects of the organization understood its responsibilities, where it's going and where its future is. And I'm doing this very quickly because I know you have, Mr. Chair and members, other folks to hear from. This is just an organizational chart. There's an executive director, two deputy directors, and four divisions within Minges. Additionally, Minges also has a relationship with the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group and the task force, both of which are established by Minnesota Statute 299C65. Policy Group has responsibility for statewide integration. It works in collaboration with the BCA superintendent in that I work for both the Policy Group as their executive director, and I also work for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and report to the superintendent. So I really have two hats that I wear and two organizations that I service. And again, Minges is responsible for the day-to-day integration operations and activities. So who do we serve at Minges? We have more than 1,500 police officers, 300 judges, 2,500 court staff, 357 public defenders, 87 county attorneys, 4,400 state and local correction peoples, victims, advocacy groups, state, federal, criminal, and non-criminal justice agencies, the public, and, of course, the legislature. We have a lot of folks that use our service. We have a number of services that are available, from criminal history to training folks on how to use our systems and our data. We have an auditing component. We conduct all of the and operate the fingerprinting systems that identify individuals through biometrics, and also all of the live scan devices that are throughout the state of Minnesota at various detention facilities. We provide technical support for agencies and for their vendors to hook into state systems. A big component of our operation is data practices to ensure that all the information we have is compliant with Chapter 13, and even more complex, to ensure that when folks access our information, they only get to see what the law says they get to see. And that is a very complex endeavor, to be sure. And we also have a communications function that works in dealing with our constituencies on an outreach basis. So, the main way in which we provide our data throughout the state of Minnesota is the Criminal Justice Data Network. It is a secure system provided by the state of Minnesota. It is regulated by Minnesota Statute 299C46. And for the most part, that data is delivered through the law enforcement message switch. I won't make it any more complex than what it needs to be. But if you just think of all of the police officers on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the state of Minnesota, all the sheriff's deputies, all the state troopers, all of the dispatch centers, all of them are connected through the law enforcement message switch, which delivers over 100,000 informational transactions into mobile environments and into offices on a daily basis. We also have a number of other applications, integrated search service, probation booking is something that I would like to just briefly mention. It is our newest system that we worked on. One of the beauties of having the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force is that it allows all the various criminal justice users to be able to contact us and vet through that working group ideas they have on how they might be able to take criminal justice information and make it work better for them. This request came from probation officers who said, we are responsible to monitor the activities of people who are in our custody. And oftentimes we don't know what they are experiencing. In specific terms, an individual can get arrested and their probation officer may never find out about it, or it may take a very long time to find out about it. With this change we made to the system, whenever an individual is arrested in the state of Minnesota, their biometric identification is searched against the Department of Corrections database for people who are under custody. When we get a hit, it generates an email message to the probation officer that this individual has just been arrested and gives them where they can contact the law enforcement agency that made that arrest so they can determine whether or not this individual has now committed a violation that should be noted. And it works very well. It's been working now for the last 6 months with great success. We also administer the Predatory Offender Registry. Just there was a question here earlier in regard to geographic ability to search that. The POR files are geocoded. They are available to be searched by law enforcement agencies in great detail, the public at a little bit minor detail, but not to the level where you would get down where the understanding where these individuals are at would identify them. Understanding that a number of these identities are protected as private or confidential data, so you couldn't go onto a particular street and find out that an individual lived there, because then you would be able to identify them, and data practices does not allow you to do that under most circumstances. Non-compliant POR registrants you can, and level 3 sex offenders you can, the rest of them you cannot. But we do have geocoding as a component, and it is used by law enforcement all the time. And can also be accessed by an individual should they wish to know in an immediate area how many offenders, predatory offenders, may be living. Again, they don't get any information on who their identity is. We also have electronic e-charging. Our statute service provides information on current statutes, how they're enhanced, so forth, and, of course, criminal history. We operate the criminal history system, which is the backbone of the criminal justice information system. We have a number of other systems, including MRAP, which is the statewide booking photo repository used to bring together the photos of individuals who have been arrested and used very frequently by law enforcement for identification purposes for photo lineups and the like. E-charging is one of our core priorities. We have four core priority projects that I will go over very quickly. E-charging is the ability to electronically take incident reports generated by law enforcement in the field, electronically transmit that to the prosecuting attorney. It goes automatically into their prosecution system. They then are able to decide whether they will issue a criminal charge. If they are going to issue a criminal charge, they draft it. They send it electronically back to the police department. The police officer who is responsible for that then has the ability to review it. If it's accurate, they can electronically sign it, and it's notarized, and they receive the oath of signing that from the notary. That's all done electronically. It then is sent electronically up to the court. It goes to the judge who's reviewing complaints electronically. The judge reads it. The judge signs it electronically. The judge files it electronically, and nobody leaves home. This is the only state in the country that has this. We are getting inquiries like crazy from all over the country. That just think about the advantages of this. And if I have, Mr. Chair, I would ask you if I have 2 minutes to indulge in a video that displays this, or whether you have the time to see that.
You betcha. Go ahead.
Now we'll see if the technology guy can make it work.
Mountain Range Courthouse is one of the first places in the country where they have started using e-charging. It's an internet program that speeds up the legal process. Renee Pasal joins us. Renee, why is this debuting on the Iron Range?
Well, Denny, St. Louis County has built a reputation for being ready for new things, and Virginia had the staff up for the challenge.
It's this type of technology that helps us.
It's called e-charging, a cutting-edge pilot program at the Virginia Courthouse. Once the initial criminal complaint is entered into the computer, the rest of the official business can be finished with a few clicks of a mouse. Prosecutor Gordon Coldagelli explains.
Once that complaint is done, I receive a notification, an email notification that the complaint is done. At that point, I can pull up the complaint, review it, and then sign it electronically.
The signature requires a password. When he hits send, it goes immediately to the police officer or deputy on the case.
So it's over at the Virginia Police Department right now.
Then after law enforcement electronically signs it, it's emailed back to the courts and finally the judge.
And that one shows that Judge Pagliacetti signed the complaint.
When we were there, it only took about 25 minutes for all three offices to finish up, and no one had to leave their desks. Now the police department is within walking distance of the courthouse, and the sheriff's department is in the basement. But that extra travel time adds up. Plus, the court staff is usually involved, too. The e-charging makes each case more efficient.
On a busy day, where we have a lot of people that are in custody and there are a lot of complaints to be signed, it could save up to maybe an hour of deputies' time.
That's time they can spend on other duties.
The only downside is we're not going to get the exercise we did walking up and down the stairs.
I think it's a real tribute to the system that we have up here. It is the first place in the state of Minnesota.
Eveleth and the other Quad Cities will be included next in the e-charging program, and then other communities served by the Virginia Courthouse, like Babbitt and Ely. Obviously, they will see a big time savings. Then the program will be expanded to the Hibbing area, and then finally Duluth. On the Range, I'm Ray Pasal for Eyewitness News.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Go ahead.
So what you might ask is, what kind of savings are we talking about? This is rolled out with all components in Carver County. Carver County has done an estimate, and they believe it will save them in in-kind expenses and direct expenses $500,000 in the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. So when you extrapolate that out, it produces quite a bit of savings. And what I'd really like you to think about is how many towns, especially in rural Minnesota, have one or two police officers on duty who end up getting tied up driving from, in the case of St. Louis County, from Ely down to Virginia to file a complaint, going back to sign it, back and forth. And when they leave town, someone has to cover their city or it goes uncovered. Again, this is a service that the state is providing. There is no fee to any of the local agencies. Comprehensive incident-based reporting system, CYBRS, that's the statewide integration of incident data. At the present time, we have 115 agencies submitting, 124 accessing, 400,000 records, with Minneapolis and St. Paul in the process of joining the system, Minneapolis bringing in 10 years worth of historical data to enrich the database. Again, a system that was funded by the legislature and is regulated by state law. Name event index service works hand-in-hand with the integrated search service, which is my next slide. That is the Google of criminal justice information in the state of Minnesota. That is a system that's available to all law enforcement and other bona fide users in the state of Minnesota through the criminal justice data network, and it's going to bring together most of the systems where you just sign into integrated search service, and then the rest of the systems become available to bona fide users as they are qualified to use the data. The best thing that I can describe for those two services is that the locals in the state of Minnesota, sheriff's departments, troopers, and police agencies, go out and they collect the dots. It is MNJIS's responsibility to connect those dots and then to deliver those connections to authorized and bona fide users so they can make the best decisions possible. And we all know, we hear from constituents on a regular basis, why doesn't the left hand know what the right hand knows? How is it Target can keep track of all the socks and you can't keep track of other people? And we are closing the gap on that, and these are the systems that is doing it. And that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you much, Mr. Johnson. And Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson. You said that somebody couldn't find who lives on an address, and I remember going to many meetings, both four-pack, different community meetings, the sex offender registration meetings, where they say that the cops say that anybody can go in and find the ones in the 4th Precinct or in their break, because the 4th Precinct breaks it north side into three divisions and things like that, and they said you can go in search by that, and it actually has the block on an address. I mean, it doesn't have the actual address, but it has like 40XX Thomas or something like that. So I guess I don't understand. You said you couldn't find by a street, and yet I'm told at all the meetings, and I've seen the actual flyers, which they say are in there, where it's got, as an example, 40XX Thomas, which means the block and street. I guess I don't understand what you were saying, or maybe...
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, Minneapolis is using data that's within their system, in their CAPERS system, and they're geocoding it and delivering it through their community crime prevention programs and their neighborhood issues. What we're talking about is a statewide database system that is regulated in a different way than what the incident data and what Minneapolis might have. So it's just the methodology and the source of the data, sir.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this isn't incident data. It's just the registered number. Incident where they did something could have been Ely, Minnesota, but if they moved in there, then they're on that. So it's not the incident data.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mulry, I would have to go over there and see exactly how they are doing that, but they're not. What I'm indicating is that it's not being delivered through a state system, it's being delivered through their system. And they must have a methodology in which they're taking data that's provided to them and then manipulating it for their purpose to display through their neighborhood program.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Sure.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, thank you for your presentation. This is one that's near and dear to my heart, so I appreciate your knowledge in this area. I won't bore the committee with all kinds of questions. You and I can follow up with that later. But just a few questions I do have for you in front of the committee, and that is the Comprehensive Incident-Based Reporting System. Is that, you said it's being submitted by over 100 law enforcement agencies. Are they able to actually use it as well and be able to access it? And as a follow-up to that, is it just an incident reporting system, or is it also an intelligence database that helps them build cases, or is it just a report tracking system?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the source of the data comes from records management systems that feed directly into the cyber system. It is regulated by statute, and it can only be used for purposes that have been authorized by the legislature, predominantly to investigate criminal activity. It can also be used for police background checks, can be used for finding missing persons, and also to be used as a source of information prior to executing legal documents and warrants. But those are the only purposes. It is not a criminal intelligence database. It gathers a minimum of 6 fields of data, a maximum of 126 fields of data. And again, it comes directly from those records management systems at the local level. Any agency in the state of Minnesota can sign up, do an agency agreement. Everybody who accesses it has to take a test to be a bona fide user. There is no cost for it, so as many police officers and as many police agencies as there are in the state of Minnesota can access it. And again, we've got 114 jurisdictions out of 400 and some in the state of Minnesota that are contributing. Of course, our goal is to enrich the database with 100%. Should also note that all of the costs associated with this, including the building of the interfaces at the present time, have been paid for by the state.
Representative Woodard?
Yeah, quick follow-up question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, along those same lines then, you mentioned about Target Socks. Is there an effort underway to learned from the private sector on this particular area, because I know that certainly some of the major retailers here that are based here in Minnesota have some very, very vibrant programs in this area because they build cases on organized retail theft, those kinds of things. So what does that interaction look like with the private sector on that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, really, I'm not trying to be flippant about this, but it's really those people coming to see how we're approaching this issue. The name event index service is, this is the only state that has found a way to make this work. When it comes to full deployment, it will have sources from 26 different criminal justice events. It looks for various methodologies from date of birth to biometric verifiers to build a level of confidence on who it is you are searching, and searching all of the various sources in the criminal justice. So when you ran a name or an individual, it would go out and search all of these various databases, bring them back to you, and then rank order them by a level of confidence and how sure you are that this is the correct information, and then point you to the agency that's got all of the information on the particular events that are associated with that person. When you think about the value that that brings to all of the various criminal justice practitioners in Minnesota, it's phenomenal. And we spend a fair amount of time explaining to other states and folks saying, how did you ever figure this out, and how are you making this work?
Representative Mullery, and then we probably should think about getting the human rights people up here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to clear up for the committee. I made a mistake on the department. I thought the Sexual Assault Prevention Unit, headed by Patty Wetterling, was in public safety. It seemed natural to me. I found out from a note that it's actually in the health department. But it would be interesting to see if the federal funds come from the U.S. Department of Health or some other more related to public safety.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Representative McDonald, sorry.
Thank you, Chairman. I know you want to wrap this up and get on to the next program, but just I wanted to talk to Superintendent Bjerga regarding the Amber Alert again. Mrs. Rasmussen mentioned the texting and stuff, and I don't want to overindulge, but we live by the phone nowadays, and I think I can't think of anything worse for a parent is a missing child. And I think as a state, we can do everything we can to ensure that we bring them back successfully. And since 2002, all 23 missing Amber Alerts, where missing children were brought back successfully. So I want to hear about the success or the details of the texting. I think if my child gone missing, I would like to have for sure a text go out. It'd be comforting to know that a text went out to everyone that owns one of these phones that with a photograph of the perpetrator and the information. So she mentioned texting, so I just wanted to hear in detail, is that a big bulk of the way you can get the Amber Alert out? I know personally as a parent, if that was the case, I would feel comforted that this was the main mechanism amongst many that would go, that Amber Alert go out, because we're on the move. We're out and about in stores and in shops and so on and so forth. I think this would be the best method, and perhaps you're doing that, and if not, I would like to see BCA encouraged to do so.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we are doing that. The Wireless Foundation does free alerting and text messaging to every cell phone in the United States for free. So if you go to the Wireless Foundation, you can sign up your cell phone to receive the Amber Alerts just in the state of Minnesota or any other state that you would like to receive them by, and you can find that on our website.
Mr. Chairman,
McDonald.
And that's photographs as well as texting them. It's all the information we need.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, yes, we can send the photograph of the child, the suspect, the vehicle, and then any other information as well.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald.
Mrs. Rasmussen, what kind of communication are you doing to educate the population that this service is out there for us? I have not heard of it, and of course I have a store, Verizon store in my hometown. They're not probably, I don't know if they're aware of it, but I was not aware of it, and I don't know anyone that is. So what information are you doing to educate the public that this is a program that's available?
Ms. Rasmussen.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we are posting that information on our website. We have a Facebook page, and we're using other social media tools to put information out on how to get the Amber Alerts in the state. And then each time we have an Amber Alert or an opportunity to work with the media, we do awareness and put the information out and explain how the public can receive alerts and text messages as well.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mrs. Rasmussen.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
My CA or CLA will probably contact you about a future tour, hopefully, of the BCA lab especially. I know I get a special thrill among walking your large
locker of handguns myself. But
that's what I was going to suggest.
And yeah, it's a collection like you've never seen before, that and ammunition. And then the testing labs, all that's very interesting. So thank
we
you
look forward
much.
To that. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, do you take samples when you're in there?
All right, we're going to have the human rights folks come up. While they're coming up, I heard an interesting analogy yesterday, and they talked about the justice system being a habitat or an ecosystem. And I'm sure Mr. or Representative Smith, if he were here, would agree that between the judiciary and the law enforcement, you're talking the BCA and the lab, everybody wants to be held harmless, but as soon as you do that, whatever that means nowadays, then you put the big bite on the other agency. And so for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So we got to keep that in mind. If you pinch one, the other one's going to suffer. So we'll have to get our heads together and figure this all out by the end of the time. But this whole system kind of revolves around each other and make it successful. So. Ma'am, if you go ahead and state your name and title.
Good morning, go ahead. Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Wendy Adler Robinson, and I am currently the acting commissioner of the State Human Rights Department. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide you an overview of our agency today. The Department of Human Rights mission is to make Minnesota discrimination-free. The department pursues this mission through a coordinated program of law enforcement, prevention education, and community-based conflict resolution. We have 36 employees, and we are located in downtown St. Paul. Last September, we opened an office in St. Cloud that has 1.5 full-time employees. This office is 100% funded by St. Cloud and St. Joseph in a joint powers agreement. The core functions of the department are to develop and oversee statewide human rights policies and programs. We receive, investigate, and make determinations on charges alleging unfair discriminatory practices. We monitor state contractor compliance with applicable affirmative action provisions. We educate to eliminate unfair discriminatory practices. We develop and disseminate technical assistance to persons subject to the provisions of the Human Rights Act. And we assess human rights compliance through voluntary settlement agreements and corrective action plans. We are 96% funded by the general fund, and about 85% of that is for staffing. The department derives its authority and enforcement responsibilities from the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which is Minnesota Statute 363A, and its implementing rules. There are three main departmental operations: case processing, contract compliance, and an education and program development. The case processing function is to receive and investigate charges which allege the illegal discrimination that occurred in Minnesota. The compliance function is to ensure that businesses that do business with the state must comply with the state's affirmative action law. And the education and program development function is to increase the knowledge of human rights policies, practices, rights, and responsibilities of the general public. With the continuous decrease in state budget and subsequently with state agencies and our department's budget, our resources have drastically diminished over the past few bienniums, and any additional shrinkage will result in some challenging times for us and the department to continue to enforce our laws. I thank you again for the opportunity to address the committee, and I am available to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Any questions from members? Yes, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not good at exactly what it's called, but when and your assistants worked with me on some of it, the minority hiring issues. And right now, if we ask or somebody asks, for instance, if a certain contractor is complying, what their rate of compliance is overall or something like that, we can't get anything back without you going through each paper file. I was told that there's a system going to be up and running. How soon will that will actually be able to produce meaningful data on these issues? How soon will that be, and do you, is it funded? And just, I'm very concerned because right now we're totally getting no information that we can, that's useful because of the fact, the lack of a system there. How soon will we have that, and is there any problem? Is that funded and things like that, so that we'll be sure and get it by whatever it's supposed to be?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, the department did establish a new case management system in 2008. The new system went live in September of 2009. It is not quite as sophisticated as the BCAZ charging system, but it is a system wherein all of the data from charges and contract compliance, that information is all scanned and available for anyone to retrieve reports and information. In particular, you're discussing the contract compliance program. In that area, our investigators monitor state contractor compliance for affirmative action requirements. There are a number of state construction projects that the investigators monitor to ensure that goals are being met on those projects for the hiring of women and minorities. This data is now being scanned into our new case management system, and the reports should be available, if they aren't at this time, very shortly. We'll analyze all that information and be able to produce a report upon request. I am not sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, at when you were requesting this data, but my understanding is that you should be able to obtain it at any time now.
Representative Mullery?
Mr. Chairman, I had asked this summer, and I was told it would be within the next year or two.
Okay.
So, and another thing, and your assistant was also at a meeting this summer on MnDOT got some federal funding for a system that helps with minority hiring information and things like that, and it was going to be looked into as to whether we could take that info system, and also, since it was federally funded and you only handle non-federal mainly, whether we could use that also in your department. And I don't know if that's been looked into or not. Do you, maybe you don't know that, or
certainly find that information out and get back to you, Representative.
Okay, Martin. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Do you have anybody else to testify today?
Not this morning, thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Adler. Robinson, just a quick question. I may have missed this, but you said that 96% of your agency is funded by the general fund. What is your annual budget?
The annual budget is approximately $3.4 million.
Okay. And then,
quick order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up question to that as well. Do you know how other states handle this particular issue? Do they have a Department of Human Rights? And if so, what how do they interact with other law enforcement agencies within the state?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the number of states have a number of similar human rights departments. There's organizations for the human rights agencies. Some states don't have any illegal discrimination laws anti-discrimination laws to enforce. There are a few that don't have that on the books, but we do, and others, they're similar. What keeps different states different are the jurisdictional areas. Minnesota covers a number of protected classes and a number of bases where illegal discrimination could occur. And I believe I haven't sent that out, but for example, Minnesota covers race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, disability, public assistance, age, sexual orientation, familial status, and local Human Rights Commission activity. So those are all the protected classes in the state of Minnesota. Some states have less, some states have more. It just depends. Some federal has less, some have more. It just depends on the jurisdiction.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Carter, I'm going to ask. Sorry, I was going to include you first off to explain some things in the packet, if you go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think today you heard from the from DPS on the BCA concerning TrimNet, MGES. Next, in the future, you're going to be hearing from DOC. They'll be talking about the CCA, CPO, probation systems, the ISR, SR offenders, Mint Core, MCOR, and EJJs. So I hope this is clear to you, but I think to help you out, in your packet is a glossary of terms that you just may want to go over, because you will see that there are a lot of acronyms out there.
Mr. Chair? Mr.
Yeah, Representative Mueller.
Chair, I think Mr. Carter forgot. He mentioned two probation systems. I believe there's three.
the DOC, excuse me. And also, one other thing, there's more of a timeline in here, too, that I think I went over briefly. This gives a little more detail on the budget process timeline.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Seeing no questions, Tuesday we're going to have our next meeting, Department of Public Safety overview, and Wednesday the Post Board overview and Department of Corrections, if we can get them both in. So unless there's any more questions, meeting adjourned.